It's Open Call with Eric and Chris.
That's me.
It's a show that you'll never want to miss. It's Open Call.
It's Open Call. I'm Chris Grace.
And I'm Eric Michaud.
And we are in London, UK.
London, England.
It's Thursday, September 5th, and we haven't done an episode in a while.
It's been a very long time. It's like it's the Baby Wants Candy podcast.
Yeah, shade already being thrown 15 seconds into the podcast. I think last time we did one was before we left for Edinburgh.
We were still in LA, yeah.
Yeah. So we've done Edinburgh, and that's over.
It's crazy.
Now we're in London.
Now we're in London.
So see you next week.
Thanks for catching up with us. We did the full run of Voldemort at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival.
Yeah.
Went really well. Great reviews again. This time with an almost completely different cast. Almost a wholly UK-based cast.
5 UK out of 7 people.
Mm-hmm. Only then, Tim Murray and I returned from the original cast last year.
Yeah. And then you also did Thrones.
I did. I did a full run of Thrones. So I did 54 shows in 27 days.
I was doing Baby Wants Candy while I was there, but then I had to go back to L.A.
Because you were shooting an episode of Superstore.
Yeah, then came back for the last weekend, helped the Voldemort cast finish up the run, and then go to Newcastle.
Mm-hmm. We did a show
one performance in Whitley Bay.
Mm-hmm.
And then come down to London, and you guys are basically 1 week into your London run at this point?
Yeah, our off-West End run at the King's Head Theatre in London.
Yeah, as of last night, it was 1 week. We've only been in London for 1 week.
It's crazy. It feels like it's been 100 years since we've been over here, so it's crazy.
Yeah, because Edinburgh feels like a long time ago, and it was only 10 days ago.
Yeah, when we did the show in Whitley Bay, I remember saying to the cast, like, you realize that we did a show in Edinburgh 2 days ago, and they were like, what?
No, Whitley Bay would have been the day before. You guys did a show. They did a show on Monday at 5 p.m. and then did a show at Whitley Bay the next day.
Which is like 2.5 hours away.
Yeah, touring in the UK is much easier because the train rides are just like, everything in the UK could fit into the state of like Alabama. Practically, you know, because like going from the top of Alabama to the bottom is probably like 3 hours.
Yeah.
And the train from Newcastle to London was like two and a half or three.
Yeah.
So setting up a tour post Fringe, or like we're maybe talking about tour dates for Voldemort next year, is just a lot more economically viable.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot less stress on the actors, because the most you'll ever be doing on a train is like 4 hours at the most.
Right. And you're on a train, so it's not like one of you has to drive or you can get up and walk around. It's like
the train is more pleasant.
Far more pleasant.
Plane.
Or than a car.
Than a car, and certainly than a bus.
Oh yeah.
And also when it's 3 hours on a train, you can literally show up 10 minutes before the train. Like, there's not much process. You just like hop on the train and like then you, from Edinburgh to Newcastle, they didn't even check our tickets.
Yeah, it wasn't, and there's no like security screening or anything like that. You get on the plane or the train and go.
Yeah. So now we're in London. We're at the King's Head Theatre, which is an off West End space,
which is like the equivalent of off Broadway.
Yeah, it is, but it's everything's a smaller scale here.
Much.
I would almost say that the West End theaters here are like the size of off-Broadway theaters.
They are small, yeah.
And then the King's Head Theater right now is set up to sell 108 tickets per night.
Mm-hmm.
But it's considered a prestigious theater. It has a good reputation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of these things that we don't have in America that are theater pubs, where it's a pub in the front and then like a theater space upstairs or in the back.
And I love it. It's such a great little setup.
Yeah, I think for like America, like Los Angeles specifically, the issue would be getting the liquor license.
Mm-hmm.
But if you got the liquor license, I feel like you could set something like this up pretty easily.
There, for people, anyone listening in Orlando, it kind of reminded me of what the old setup of Theater Downtown used to be, which was two kind of identical spaces side by side, and one of them was used as a lobby / bar / kind of entertainment hangout space. And then you could go into the theater next door.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like that, but I don't think they had a liquor license.
Interestingly, the King's Head is not alcohol sales driving the theater. It's two separate businesses.
Right.
And the theater part is a charity.
Mm-hmm.
And they have to pay £100,000 of rent to the bar every
per year. Yeah.
So it's not even like the business model is the alcohol's driving the theater.
Right.
Because of all this, I'm going to make a very hot take pronouncement. I think London is the best theater city in the world.
Whoa, fighting words.
Because it has a combination of something similar to Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
It has a really high-end thing, but it has a lot of structures built in, infrastructure that let smaller companies create theater.
It feels like there's a lot more fringe kind of shows happening year-round.
Yeah.
Like but in also these pub spaces.
And there's lots of financial help.
Oh my God, yeah.
So just as an example, at the King's Head Theater, which is 108 seats, which you would consider very small, they have an agreement where all of the actors and crew that work at the King's Head are paid British equity rates. So it means that the equivalent would be like if I produced a play at a 99-seat theater in LA and was able to get some, you know, lower but fair equity rate for equity actors, and but I could still produce a low-budget theater piece.
Mm-hmm. And not charge an astronomical amount of money for tickets.
Right. That's not really a thing right now.
It's not viable. Yeah.
In LA right now, I believe the 99-seat plan is that you have to pay the actors minimum wage for all of the rehearsals and stuff right. like that. And if you add up the numbers, it just gets to be where you have to charge like, you know, $45 a ticket for a small play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not including any of the other costs that you...
set and yeah. rights and all that.
So here I feel like in London you have the whole gamut. There's a fair amount of like independent and scrappy theater in LA, Chicago,
mm-hmm.
New York. But I don't think those cities have the same financial incentives built in where they get like here they get tax relief based on like a bunch of the expenses that have gone into Voldemort. We're mm-hmm. getting financial tax relief back.
Mm-hmm.
So in January or whatever, my co-producer, when she files her tax return, will get like money back
mm-hmm.
for stuff like your travel, the set, your lodging, like a
program
lot of the costs that
posters.
We're incurring for this are there's British artist incentives to like defray the cost of these things. As far as I know, I don't think we have those in the U.S.
So basically what we're saying is we're moving. And
yeah. Well, the problem is it's the best. I do think, and I think you also have access to... some great off West End theater companies that are producing stuff. Actually, I don't know what Chocolate Factory is considered.
I think they're considered like, West End.
Alameda, I don't think is West End. And then you do have the West End as well. So you have like the whole spectrum. I feel like New York obviously has Broadway, but I feel like in New York it's very difficult to survive and create as a mid or low tier. Artists.
Yeah, even off-Broadway, I mean, in the 80s, off-Broadway was hot. It was, yeah. You could make a great living there, you could have a great show, you could run for a while, make a profit, it could be profitable. Now, the way it's set up, off-Broadway is nearly impossible to turn a profit on.
Yeah, when we did 50 Shades there, the budget was above $700,000 to do an off-Broadway run.
With how many people in the cast?
Seven,
yeah,
maybe?
That's not a big cast,
and that was not an equity cast either,
right?
It was non-equity off Broadway,
which I'm so surprised they were able to do that.
I mean, it's just money talks. Yeah. Like, if they wouldn't need to rent their venue, they just rent the venue,
yeah.
You know, it's like the Pantages rents their venue out to
true.
Tours that are non-equity, they don't care,
yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we just passed the other day that I guess it was some kind of Actors Equity Strong Day or something because a bunch of people posted
mm-hmm.
that they were members.
It was Labor Day.
Oh, okay. I forgot that it was Labor Day. But, you know, like I was kind of like, is it a strong union? I don't know.
So do you want to talk about some stuff we saw in Edinburgh?
Yeah, sure. I only ended up seeing like, I want to say 10 or 12 shows.
Because
mm-hmm. While I was there at the beginning of the month, I was... producing a lot, taking care of a lot of production stuff, and so I didn't have that much energy to go see stuff. Let's see.
And then you were gone for a while.
Then I was gone, and then the last weekend I saw a couple things. I'm updating my list.
Unfortunately, my schedule, because of doing Voldemort, which was at 5 o'clock every day, and then Thrones at 10:30, the physical wear and tear of doing the shows plus just the scheduling of the shows limited me from seeing a lot of things I wanted to see.
I saw 18.
I saw, I think, 19 shows. I didn't see that many.
I was gone for 10 days in the middle.
I know. It's bad. But you want to jump off and say what some stuff that you saw that you really enjoyed was?
Ooh, stuff that I really enjoyed. I enjoyed Diane Chorley's Modern Love.
I did too. I saw it three times.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, Diane Chorley is a, I guess, drag character. It's hard to say. I wouldn't really call her drag. It's a camp character, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's this female character that was a big pop star in the 80s and then went to prison for a long time.
Uh-huh. For burning down
her club.
Yeah. It's all part of the mythology of this character.
Yeah, with a flamethrower because she was duetting with Grace Jones. So she's now out and she's kind of reclaiming her titles. And it's a very fun show. The music is great. Like, it's all original music. And I think that's where the real heart of the show is.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that. I saw Baby Wants Candy twice.
Ooh.
With the wonderful Chris Grace in it.
Oh.
And they
you saw both. Hitler on the Roof.
I did. And I forget what the other one was.
What was it about?
Let me look on my list.
I saw Jordan Brooks. Stand-up comic, I would say one of the best stand-ups in the world right now.
Wow.
And he ended up winning. So I saw him 2 years ago. I really loved his show 2 years ago. So he was on my short list of, like, I really want to see him this year. And he ended up winning the big Edinburgh Comedy Award.
Amazing.
So, excellent show.
The other Baby Wants Candy show I saw was Back to the Futon.
Oh, I was not in that.
You were not in that, no. Which is why I didn't remember it.
Of course. We saw Theatre Ray's Birth.
Loved it.
Yeah.
Absolutely loved it. They are a London-based, I want to say they're mostly French, but they're a London-based company that does kind of theatrical movement
I feel like the one guy is French and everyone else is British.
Maybe.
Because the main woman in this one definitely is.
Was she British?
Yeah, she's definitely British.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
But basically they do kind of storytelling through movement and dance and... It was beautiful. I saw a piece of theirs 2 years ago called The Nature of Forgetting, which I have not shut up about for 2 years. And so I was very excited to see this show called Birth, and it didn't disappoint. I loved it.
We saw, was it Dark Sides? Is that what it's called? Darkfield?
Oh, Darkfield, yeah.
Coma.
They're a company that does immersive... very, very small shows kind of in storage containers. Like, if you think of what a pod is,
yeah.
Imagine an entire theater experience happening in one of those. So we've seen two of their shows in the past called Flight and also a show called Seance.
Yeah.
So this is the third in their series called Coma. And what do you think?
I thought it was okay.
It was my least favorite.
I think
of the
if
three.
It was, I think if you've never gone to one of their pieces, I think it might be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, not as good as Flight, in my opinion.
Yeah.
Have
you seen Seance?
No.
Oh, okay. I think Flight is the best of the three.
Uh-huh.
I would put Seance in number two and Coma in the third place.
I saw Pollo Rojo.
I wish I had.
The guys from Argentina, the two dancers from Argentina. They're actually touring the East Coast of the U.S. in the next month or so. They'll be in Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, Montreal, and Toronto.
Highly recommend checking it out.
So I definitely recommend them. Pollo Rojo, P-O-Y-O-R-O-J-O, two words. It's just a really cool two-man dance piece, but it's got a lot of comedy in it. It's very, very interesting.
Speaking of comedy, the Voldemort cast, we shared dressing rooms with whatever show was before and after us.
With a little stand-up named Russell Howard.
Who I had never heard of and did not know who that was.
Yeah, he's a huge star.
He's a huge UK star. I did not know. We became very kind of chummy in the dressing room. And then I realized through people I was around that he was this big star, and I didn't know that. So we went and saw his stand-up show, and it was great. It was a work in progress, so it's definitely, you know, he's kind of working through stuff, and he was every day writing new material in the dressing room. But it was interesting to see the evolution. And he would often be
did
like...
Did you see it more than once?
I didn't, but he would often in the dressing room say, do you remember that bit that I did? I'm trying this now, and what do you think? And I was like, oh, I like that. He was bouncing stuff off of me, which was kind of fun and cool.
That's cool.
I saw a show with you called Frisky and Manish.
Uh-huh.
And what'd you think of that?
I thought you were only going to bring up shows that you liked.
I did like that.
Oh, you did?
I did. I didn't love it, but I liked it.
Oh, I thought you were just... I thought you didn't like it that much.
Oh, no. I had a good time.
Oh, it was fine.
It's like a musical mashup. They're supposed to be these two kind of pop musicians who are working in a lab, kind of dissecting music.
Yeah. It's fine. I think that it's 30% of, or if not more, of the references are lost on us.
Right.
Because they're covering songs that we've never heard, and they're making jokes
about artists who are huge here, but that we've never heard of.
Yeah. They're very talented, I will say.
Yeah. I loved the bit where they took the music,
from the Ed Sheeran?
Yeah, from The Shape of You, the dun, dun, and put it under like 15 other songs, yeah. And it worked really well.
Yeah, I think it's okay. It just doesn't, it reminds me of like Axis of Awesome. They did the four chords mm-hmm. song, and it's kind of like, it's interesting, but it's not, it's just not what, it's funny. I don't know, that's not really what I go to see theater for.
Sure.
Yeah. Like, I want to go to things that are more either sillier or more serious or something. It's like right in the middle of like, eh.
Yeah. I wouldn't necessarily call it a theater piece. I would say it was kind of a concert-y event type thing.
Speaking of which, I saw Tim Murray's stand up.
Did you?
As Tim Murray walks through our theater podcast, and it was terrible.
Oh. I'd heard that, but no one wanted to say anything.
Yeah. Everyone was like, let's all agree to.
No, I heard he was great. I heard it was really, really fun.
It was very good.
And he's going to be doing an hour of his stand-up here in London.
Oh, that's right. Sunday, September 15th.
And
at someone, the Hen and Chickens.
Who's opening for him?
Nobody. Because we're going to Amsterdam.
Oh, are we?
Well, I don't know, but.
We're going to Amsterdam, okay. Did you see Sarah Kendall this year?
No, I didn't.
She was great.
Uh-huh.
She's a Australian-based stand-up who became kind of chummy with Chris and I 2 years ago. She was not back last year, but she was back this year. It's stand-up mixed with kind of storytelling, and it was really remarkable. She's wonderful. One thing I do want to talk about, because you didn't see it this year, but you recommended I see it, was Ostentatious, which is crazy in how great it was for me. It's improv Jane Austen, which sounds terrifying and also sounds dull as dishwater, but I loved it. They did the suggestion for the show was Pride and Prejudice on the Titanic, which was not a great suggestion, but they made it work. And they are all such incredible improvisers, but also they all have such a command of the language and style of Jane Austen that it worked so well. It was such a good time. I really was a great recommendation. Thank you for that.
Yeah, they're great. They were,
and I bought their DVD. I'm very excited.
You did not see Pamela's Palace.
Oh, I wanted to. It was during Thrones, so I couldn't.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was a 3-woman show about this woman named Pamela who has a haircutting shop salon, and she's going to enter some local competition to win. And it's just, I don't even know how to describe the show, really.
That's what everyone said. Like, I was like, well, what is it about, or what is it like?
It's really about her trying to enter this contest and hopefully she wins, but it's really more just like a I don't know. Tim, how would you describe Pamela's Palace?
It was an audience interaction experience comedy about a woman trying to win a beauty competition.
Yeah.
Like a haircutting competition.
But it's weird because it's not like a play. I mean, it is a play, but like it was a very thin.
If you've ever seen Sheer Madness, that was like the closest thing I could say.
I've not seen Sheer Madness.
It's like one of my favorite types of theater. It was like improv meets theater.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you say?
Yeah, because they would break out of the context of the story a bunch.
So much, yeah. It was a lot of crowd work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What time's your show on the 15th?
9:30 p.m.
And how much does it cost?
$11,000.
Hey!
I think it's going to be like £5.
Then you'll break even for the month.
Yeah, perfect.
Well, $11,000 is £5, isn't it? Isn't that the same conversion?
Oh, not after Brexit.
Oh, good point. But now it's not happening.
Well, yeah, but... No, it is happening.
Well, now they're like, there's been a lot of developments today.
Yeah, but I mean, it's definitely happening.
Yeah.
It's just that
how it's going to happen.
They might push it back. Pamela's Palace is really good. I saw it on a night when my friends also saw it for the second time, and they said that the audience was not as good. And it's a little bit, I feel like it might be a little dependent on, we had some drunk audience members who were a little too, not even... It's like they wanted to be up on stage a lot, but then they wouldn't participate because they were drunk.
Mm.
So they just wanted to be up there.
That kind of happened. I saw, like I said, I saw Diane Charlie 3 times.
Yeah.
The second time I saw her, there was a loud drunk table in the front. that really was kind of derailing things a lot. Yeah. So there, it's hard when shows are so dependent on the audience, not only for participation, but also just for the vibe of the show.
Yeah.
It can really, really affect things. And I mean, unfortunately, that's part of Edinburgh Fringe, is that you're going to have, especially in the later night shows.
Yeah, Pamela's Palace was a 10:40 show.
Yeah, I mean, there were nights at Thrones where people were just screaming in the middle of, for no reason, because yeah. they were drunk. One thing that we both saw together that we both enjoyed, I saw it twice, was Manual Cinema's Frankenstein.
Uh-huh.
What did you think of that?
I liked it a lot.
We should describe what it is.
It's a theater company from Chicago, and they do... They project a screen, and then they basically create the story on that screen through like shadow puppets and transparencies and some live action.
They're basically making a silent film in front of you.
Yeah, there's a live orchestra, there's some live singing, there's live sound effects. And then they sometimes will use like the beginning, I would say the first 6 minutes of it was like silhouette theater depicting Mary Shelley with Lord Byron and who's her husband? Who's Mary Shelley's husband?
And he was also a Shelley because he was a poet.
Oh, that's Percy Bysshe Shelley. And then and Lord Byron. Oh, those are two different. Okay, so Mary Shelley, Percy Bysshe Shelley, and Lord Byron. It's a legendary thing. They all like stayed in a house together. There's a movie called Gothic that's about this, where they made a bet as to who could write the scariest ghost story.
Mm-hmm.
And so the first part of the Manual Cinema's Frankenstein is talking about how she had a child and the child died, and it leads up to this contest where they are going to write a ghost story, and then that's sort of what triggers her to write Frankenstein.
Right.
So then they move into sort of like half shadow puppetry, half like live actors.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting. Sometimes it was like a little physical piece, like a cutout figure,
mm-hmm.
that was a shadow, like on a old school, like from your high school or junior high,
like overhead transparencies. Yeah, yeah.
But then sometimes it would be an actual actor in front of a light,
and sometimes they would mix them.
There were
incredible moments where they would have like three things in front of the actor, and it would create the sense of depth, and you'd be going through doors and then yeah. over things, and then the actor would appear. Or
so they'd like project like a drawing of like a foyer, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where there'd be like a ledge or a railing on a staircase, and the actor would like kind of put their hand where the railing was, as if they were like leaning on it, but they weren't. You know, there wasn't anything there.
It was just a drawing.
And then they would like flip the transparency to switch to a different scene, and then the actor would like fall because like the railing went away. There was a lot of stuff where there was a lot of synchronization between the actor's physicality and the projection.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was... And there was some puppetry, like regular puppetry as well, because like when Frankenstein showed up, he was mostly a puppet.
Mm-hmm.
And some of that was like they would hold a video camera, and sometimes an actor would hold a video camera and shoot video of the puppet moving around.
Mm-hmm.
So basically there was like a bunch of different ways that they were visually creating the story, and it was all in sync with this orchestra that was playing as well.
It was one of those things while watching it, especially the second time watching it, I kept thinking, how did someone come up with this? How did yeah. someone... There are so many moving parts, and there are so many elements of... You know, changing costumes, changing wigs, and then grabbing puppets, and then grabbing cameras, and transparencies changing. There were so many moving parts, plus the live orchestra, the sound effects, and it was such a huge task. And I thought they did it so seamlessly.
It's exposed, so you can see how you can't quite see what they're doing, but you can see below the projector screen. There, you can see everybody putting it all together.
Mm-hmm.
So if you wanted to, you could just watch the actors on the stage floor, you know, running around, grabbing stuff, doing, or you can look up and see the projection and just see what the final product is.
Yeah.
So I think that's on purpose. I'm sure that's like kind of interesting
mm-hmm.
to see how that happens.
But they are on tour. They are Chicago based and they're on tour.
Oh, are they?
Yeah. They had mentioned some North American, dates. So, If you happen
that's
to see
definitely them, worth seeing.
Yeah, it's called Manual Cinema, and the show is called Frankenstein, but I highly recommend it. It was great.
The last show I have that I wanted to talk about was an interesting play called Standard Elite. It's a really interesting idea. So it's a play about, it's a, like a fable about a boy from this, what they call high ground, which is like this cloud kingdom where everybody's wealthy and has great lives. And then this girl, I think it was a girl from, I think the girl, it was weird because the actress played cross-gender, but a girl from like the mud people. So it's just a fairy tale about this mud girl and this cloud boy meet, kind of fall in love or like become friends. And then they go on this journey to the cloud kingdom. And then she sort of has one night at a party in the cloud world and sees how this amazing party that they're throwing and all the food and drink that they have. And kind of, it's about like, how come everybody from the mud world can't have this, you know? Mm. And it's stuff about how the cloud people deserve it because they've worked harder than everybody. It's obviously a fable about like rich and poor,
mm-hmm.
and privilege and not having privilege. So that's the sort of what the story is about. However, when you come into the theater, you roll this big foam die, and on, I think one side of it, there's like a crown and the other ones are just whatever, blank or whatever. And so if you roll the crown, you become an elite audience member. So at the beginning of the show, there's five audience members sitting on stage that they get, they're wearing crowns. They get these little, they like at one point they got snacks. They get these little light up thumbs and they get to sit on stage. So, and the actor, there's two actors and they present some amount of it to them directly. Like they'll turn their back to everybody else and just give them stories.
Because you're all the mud people.
Yeah. So we're the standards. I roll the standard. So everyone sitting in the regular audience seats is standard. So it's kind of a choose your own adventure fairy tale. The two actors portray various characters along the way. So there's one point where they're like, there's a turtle character and there's like a rabbit character. And they're both playing the two. And the mud girl and the cloud boy have to follow one of the two. So the elites get to vote which way the story goes. So that happens a couple times where the elites on stage get to vote and change the outcome of the story. And then there's a couple competitions where standard audience members can, like when the cloud boy showed up, the cloud boy like threw little bits of cotton all over the, like little annoying bits of cotton all around because it was like, I'm in the cloud kingdom, whatever. And then they had a contest with standard audience members to see who could pick up the most,
mm-hmm.
Which is just like an excuse for them to like clean up the stage. But like, they were like, whoever wants to compete. And then five people came down and they were like, go. And they just ran around cleaning up the cotton. And then they presented it and they were like, you got the most. Now you're an elite. So that person was promoted to an elite seat.
Was there then six elites or did one of them have to sit down?
No, then there's a rule that you have to have an odd number because of the voting. So then that person got to bring someone from the audience up with them.
Oh, but it wasn't like one of the elites got bumped off.
Once we got to nine, then there were two more. There's another contest. And those people picked who to replace. Those people went back to the standard seats. There's a lot of like, you know, that kind of cutthroat kind of stuff in it. And then at the end of the story, the girl, the mud girl, basically led a revolt against the cloud kingdom. And then the two actors like led a revolt against each other on stage. So they led a revolt of the standard audience members against the elite audience members.
Interesting.
So it's long, it's an interesting, it's probably more interesting talking about it and me describing it than actually saying it. Because I think it's a very interesting play, and I might be worth investigating for people if they want to produce something. Because it's only two actors and there's a third sort of-ish character, but you could produce it for pretty cheap. I don't know if it's able to license or whatever, but it's an interesting play.
Neat.
It's definitely thought-provoking. It's kind of like game-like.
Uh-huh.
So, yeah, that was probably the most interesting play I saw.
Very cool.
Yeah.
The one last show that I wanted to talk about, well, actually, there's two more, but there's one I wanted to talk about because one of them is being produced by your co-producer.
Uh-huh.
I saw a musical called Unfortunate,
yep.
Which was, it's by a company called Fat Rascal. They did a musical last year and they brought it again back this year called Wolverine,
uh-huh.
Which I saw twice last year and really, really enjoyed. So it's the same cast and a lot of the same creative team have brought the show Unfortunate, which is basically the Little Mermaid from Ariel, from Ursula's point of view.
Yeah.
Very, very fun show. Great music. Small five-person cast. I think if they want to license this show, I feel like it will do very, very well. But it was really funny and just kind of an interesting kind of Wicked-esque take on the story of Ursula's misunderstood. She's actually right in most of what she did. And here's why. Uh-huh. But it was really interesting. But the last show I wanted to talk about, I saw this great show called John Accardo, Method to the Magic.
Oh, yes. I didn't put that on my list.
Jeez.
I saw that like 8 times.
And you also produced it.
Yeah, I produced it. Oh, Tim Murray's parents, very sophisticated, distinguished theater goers.
And it was their favorite show of the whole Fringe.
They saw like 20 shows, and it was their favorite.
Well, that's great.
Go. They said it with John Carter was their favorite show. And you know, Tim Murray's dad is always on the cutting edge of knowing what's hot. I've been told that Tim's dad likes to be in the know about like the next big thing.
I enjoyed Tim's stories about he would recommend things for them to go see and then they wouldn't go see it. And he would purposely say like, don't go see this. This is terrible. And they would go see that and then complain after about that it was bad.
I'd straight up be like, do not go see News Review. It's a British comedy show about British politics, which you're not getting on your day to day. So you're not going to understand any of the references. The next day they went to it and they were like, we didn't understand a single thing they were talking about.
John Accardo, you saw it early in the month, right?
I saw it twice.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I did. I saw it early in the run and then I saw it a week in, I think.
Oh, okay.
But it was great. It was really, really great. I also saw the dress rehearsal and I thought it had grown considerably from the dress rehearsal.
The dress rehearsal in LA? Oh,
yeah. Okay. But yeah, a really, really great, very personal show. I was really proud of him. I think he stepped way outside of his comfort zone, and it paid off, I think.
He worked very hard on that show.
And it showed.
Yeah. I think that once I created a framework for it that made it more theatrical and more Fringe-like, he really ran with it. So, like, I mean, I wrote a very, very rough draft at the beginning that was like, what if we did the show like this and started with that dream framework of like, what if we started, instead of it being like, hey, welcome to the Magic Show, thanks for coming, blah, 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 what if it started with like a more theatrical opening?
I had a dream last night.
Yeah. The first effect of the show is presented as if he had a dream about it, which I actually don't think is super original to me. I think that's been done before, but that's pretty much all I did. I established a little bit of tone, and then John really like took that tone and like wrote the rest of the script based on that.
Mm-hmm.
And he also made the, he really went for a not just trying to do. I mean, he will say that John and I host a magic podcast, and he has said as much on his podcast that he didn't prioritize the magic effects being the most amazing magic effects. He prioritized the script around them being the most like personal and interesting. So, I mean, because some of the tricks he did in the show are like, they're not stock, but they're like, they've been done, like you've seen people do them before.
Mm-hmm.
And so those pieces might get substituted out at some point.
Sure.
When he finds like effects that are more amazing or individual to him.
Mm-hmm.
But I think by using some stuff that he already knew how to do, it allowed him to concentrate on the script as opposed to the magic part of it. And I think made it different.
I think it made it different, and I think it made it far more theatrical, and it felt more like a Fringe piece than just a magic show.
I think I think it made it feel like one piece as opposed to...
It was cohesive.
Yeah, and I do think one big advantage of it is I feel like people got to know him. They felt like after the show was over, they had really gotten to know him.
Yeah.
Which is not true of a lot of magic shows.
A lot of magic is very distancing. You see the glitz and the razzmatazz, but you don't actually ever see the person.
Yeah.
And I think with this show, you really did see John. You saw his insecurities. You saw his passion. You saw a lot about him himself.
Yeah.
Which was really great.
Yeah.
It was really, really great. I was really proud of him.
So now we're in London.
Yes.
Have we already seen two plays in London?
We have.
Or you have.
I have. One. You saw one.
We should talk about those.
I was saying, because we, how long have we run? Do you want to?
We're only at 35.
Oh, okay.
What are you talking about? Because we're going to see some, I'm going to see some, at least a few before the next episode. So
okay. Yeah, I'm planning on seeing a couple of shows. The musical Big is about to open here, which I saw on its national tour back in 1996, I think. So I'm interested to see.
Are there any special effects in this?
In Big? Yeah. I mean, the original Broadway show was all special
effects. Oh, really?
Like, it was.
Well, it's funny because the movie actually doesn't really have many special effects.
Yeah.
The movie's just like, now you see Tom Hanks. It's not like there's a big sequence where...
Oh, yeah. No, nothing like that specifically, but like the original Broadway production was like a $15 million show in 1995, which was huge. Yeah. It was this giant show. And it was all spectacle, spectacle, spectacle. So it'll be interesting to see what they do with it over here, how it works. So I'm excited to see that. But we did see a little show. Was that yesterday? That was only yesterday.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. Called Queen of the Mist, which is a Michael John Lacusa musical, which I had never seen and only heard little tiny bits of before. So it's playing off West End. It's its London premiere.
It's at the Charing Cross Theater in the Arches, which is near Trafalgar Square. It's a very cool theater
and yeah.
cool space.
Uh-huh.
But this show is a mess. That's what I will say. I think that the actors are very talented, and I think the music is great.
Vocally, it was... very well done.
Vocally great. I think it's all... I don't fault really this company for... I just think the script is a mess. Like, I don't think there's any way to do the show in a way that's compelling. So I think that the theater company is doing their best, and they're probably ringing as much... Especially, like, musical vocal moments. There's a lot. Like, there's a lot of beautiful harmonies in it. There's mm-hmm. a lot of very nice music in it. It actually almost reminded me of like an opera in a way where it's just like sometimes when you go to opera, you're like, ugh, this plot's so dumb. Like the narrative storytelling part of an opera sometimes is like set aside for the vocal, like
for the
fireworks.
Yeah.
And in this case, I think if you went to enjoy it as a little bit of a story with some really good singing in it, maybe you would, if you lower your expectations to that, maybe. But maybe. The narrative element of this script, no fault of the theater company, pretty much all the fault of Michael John Cusa, I would guess.
Wow.
Doesn't it just falls apart. Like, it's not interesting.
It is not interesting, and it does kind of fall apart. And it was one of those shows where throughout I was thinking, why did he feel the need to musicalize this? Like, why yeah. did he feel this piece was screaming out to be a musical or this story?
Yeah.
It was not compelling. There were, and the story, and I think that is the fault of the storytelling, because I think there is a compelling story in this woman's life.
Yeah.
It's based on Anna Edison Taylor. She was the first woman to go over Niagara Falls in a barrel and survive.
She shot the run. They kept saying that as if I knew what that jargon was.
Right.
Oh, you shot it? It's like, what?
Like, you shot it? Yeah. So I think there is a compelling story. She ended up trying to go on lecture circuits after this because she did not see it as a stunt. She saw it as a feat of science that she had designed this barrel herself. She had done all the mathematics of which is the right route, which is the safest way to do this. So like she had calculated a lot of, and done a lot of work
yeah.
to make sure that she survived this, but it was treated as kind of a gimmick and a stunt and she was like treated like a huckster.
Yeah, although the show kind of presents her as a huckster at the beginning.
That's the thing.
Because like she's like late on rent and she keeps running from one town to another.
Yeah, she keeps like dodging the police. Setting up these
dance studios with zero students. The landlord comes in like, you got to pay, and then she's on the run. That's not like a woman of science.
Right.
Right. You know.
So it's like you're presenting her one way and then suddenly you're presenting her a different way. And there was a whole kind of subplot of her manager who was managing her during the event, who then she fires and accuses of stealing from her.
The
and
biggest that's issue never clear. With that is it's not clear what the truth is there, and it's not clear if it's supposed to be ambiguous, but basically you never know if the manager stole money from her or not.
And that's like, important.
It's important for you to, like, it can go either way. So, but it's important to, like, what does the story think of her? Is she crazy? Is she paranoid? Or has she been sort of... like wronged by these people.
Right. And without knowing that, it's hard to feel anything for her because you don't know how you feel about her.
Yeah. I thought of something you just said, revealed something to me, which is, I think one of the issues with this show is I think you need to have a super charismatic lead actor to sell this show to the point that you don't really think about the flaws in the story.
Mm.
But then in the second act, they keep talking about how she's boring and monotone.
Right.
So I think that's tough too. So she's not like, is Annie Get Your Gun like about a person doing shows?
Yeah.
It's not like she's like some amazing, you know, Gypsy performer. Rose Lee show performer and everybody's wowed by her, because the whole second act is like, no one cares. She goes to do her circuit speeches and everybody's bored.
Right. Everyone's bored, and she won't answer the most compelling question about what did it feel like when you went over the falls. She refuses to answer that. So, she's not, and she ends up dying penniless. She's a pauper.
Yeah.
So it's like, if she wasn't interesting in her time, the actual person, why is she interesting now when she's singing?
The other thing that you said that reminded me of this thought I've heard before is that a successful production of a play or musical captures the feeling that the author had when they were writing it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it captures that flash of inspiration that they had that made them want to write the show to begin with.
Uh-huh.
And the question about why did he want to musicalize this, it's like, this show definitely didn't portray that, because I was like, both of us are just like, what is the point of this show?
Right.
But I'm questioning whether or not the script even has the ability to reveal that at all. Because my guess is that the reason you musicalize this is she's a fascinating woman who did something like way before people thought women could even achieve things like this. She's important in that sense. She's super smart. My guess is that she's like a really brilliant, bristly, hard to get along with person that is still like a genius and achieves things despite the fact that people don't like her. That's kind of what I'm gathering.
Kind of a P.L. Travers. Kind of a P.L. Travers.
Yeah. And maybe there's things that are interesting about how we accept a lot of cranky geniuses as men, but not as women.
Oh.
But those are all things I'm thinking about like on my own that I didn't really gather from this.
No, yeah, show. None of that is presented in the script as yeah, it is.
There's a little bit of like women's solidarity with her and Carrie Nation.
Yeah.
But that felt very rushed. And I'll be frank, like some of the script writing, the music is beautiful in the show.
Yeah.
I think some of the script writing and dialogue is like
truly
straight
terrible.
Up bad.
Yeah, like, truly terrible.
Some of
it,
and some of the lyrics are really bad. There's one song that was just like
the Carrie Nation, where she's with Carrie Nation,
the after the Carrie Nation song. Yeah, that was just like really, really bad.
Yeah. Well, that was another song that bothered me, because she throughout it kept saying it's, you know, there were two sides to this character. She kept at the beginning, she kept saying like, I'm going to make $1 million. I'm going to make so much money doing this. I'm going to be famous. I'm going to make money. That's the only reason I'm doing this, is I need the money. And then it became, no, this is for science. This is a feat. This is an event. But then again, she went back to, in that Carrie Nation scene, about, come on, let's team up. We can make a ton of money.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know if this woman is to be trusted, if she's a huckster, if she's a sham. What is she?
Yeah. Or is it meant to be I don't quite know about her. You know, here's another angle you could pursue, which I don't think is in the script. The fact that we don't know what happened to her when she was in the barrel falling, maybe that's like, we don't know what to think of her because she's an ambiguous character. Maybe there's a scene where we hear from all these different characters that say like, she was a huckster, she was a great scientist, she cared about money, she didn't care at all about money. Maybe she's supposed to be this enigma.
Right.
But again, that's not in the script. It's just me making shit up right now.
To be completely honest, while we were watching the show, when she kept refusing to answer what it was like going over in the barrel, I thought it was going to be revealed that she actually didn't. That she couldn't describe it because she faked it and didn't do it.
There was some intimation later that some people accused her of that.
Yeah. So it's like, that's what I thought at first when she
refused. I feel like I heard them accuse her of that at one point.
I think so. I don't remember for sure.
Yeah, it's funny because I was ready for the second act to just go crazy, and I was like, I know this is not really what happened, but at one point I was like, It'd be cool if like she got replaced by an alien and this wasn't her anymore. Like, because they were just, I just wanted something to happen in the plot. The other thing I thought was maybe she died and like the whole second act was like
just a fantasy.
Just a fantasy.
Eh, that would have been neat.
But
she didn't.
But I mean, yeah, this might be another show that if we describe it to you, it sounds more interesting than it really was.
Yeah, it was quite dull. Yeah. I did hear at least two people during intermission say they fell asleep during act one. And I felt like act one was...
the two people, you and me?
No.
Because I definitely fell asleep.
Two other people. And act one I felt was better than act two.
Act one is better than act two. Because act one, the act break was kind of still intriguing because she'd just gotten in.
Right.
And you're like, ooh, I wonder what's going to happen.
I did think some of the direction was not great in this production as well.
Yeah. That was okay. I don't know. I think that it was, I don't know what you call this. Actors, the audience is on two sides of the stage.
Yeah, it's not really theater in the round. It's not
in the round because there was, it was, I don't know. It was kind of like, I'm trying to think of what else I've seen. It's like if you saw Once on This Island at Circle and Square, but without the end points.
Yeah.
So it's really just, maybe it's promenade setup or something?
It's there. Yeah, the stage was in the center of the room and there was audience seating on both sides.
You had to step on the stage to get to our seats.
Yeah, it's kind of like a runway through the middle of the stage, the middle of the room.
So if the Charing Cross Theater is always like that, then I would say they did okay with the layout. But if they chose to make it like that, then I don't think that was a good idea.
No.
Like, it didn't really serve the show. It just kind of served, like, I was always very aware of, like, oh, I'm watching her back as she sings this lyric.
And then
I was like, and she's going to turn to us now.
Yep. There was nothing exciting about the staging in that you knew half of it was going to be looking at her back and half of it was going to be her coming at you.
Or if there are four people, two of them would look at us.
Yeah.
You know.
Which also causes a problem with focus, because if you're having to stage your actors facing in different directions so that people can see somebody, then it's the intimacy of that scene may be kind of lost.
And there's really no way to get a moment focused with everybody looking at it.
Mm-hmm.
Unless they are profile to us.
Well, that's what, like the final moment of the show where they kind of crowned her as queen. There were these objects that they kept using throughout the show, the ensemble, and it was like a tennis racket, and it was, but none of these objects had anything to do with her. They were never referenced in any way. That's one of the biggest direction problems I had.
You seem like I think you would call super textual, where it's like, it's not subtext; it's being added on to the text by the director, and there's nothing in the text to support it because they don't talk about like. I'm holding a globe. So you're just trying to add meaning to it by them holding them.
Right. But then they use them at the end to like make her a queen. So like her scepter was a tennis racket. And I'm like, why a tennis racket of all things?
But also, was that crown one of the...
No, that just came out of nowhere.
That's just kind of like,
yeah, whatever. The crown was just like, oh, here we are.
Yeah.
But that whole last tableau, she was facing the wall. Because yeah, they wanted us to see
by everybody.
So it was profile. So it was just like this wonderful tableau that meant nothing. And we couldn't really see because it was kind of poorly lit from the side. Also, like there was a centerpiece in the floor that was clearly cut into a circle that I kept waiting for it to revolve.
Yeah.
And then it never did.
Yeah, that was weird.
Yeah.
So you're glad you saw it. This is the first Lacusa you've seen.
It's the first Lacusa I've ever seen on stage. And I do, I really love a lot of his work. The Wild Party is one of my favorite musicals. I love it. But I've never actually seen it. And this is not a show that I see getting done very often.
Yeah.
So to see a professional, fully staged, well sung with a full orchestra production was lovely.
Yeah.
And I'm glad we saw it. Unfortunately, I wouldn't recommend it to many people.
No, I'd probably if you're a Lacusa completist.
Yeah.
And really want to see everything live.
I will
say, want to see a bunch of people do terrible American accents.
Oh yeah, there's that. Oh, that scene. The scene with the fraud.
Anna. The woman who played Anna, actually her accent was good.
Right.
Her accent was pretty much fine.
Yeah.
The whole show. And she had the biggest like
chunk of it.
Yeah. And some people their main character would be okay. And then like when they play their secondary character would be like, ooh. Ooh. Boy.
You didn't do so much accent work on this one, did you?
Yeah. It's weird when people are like, they have a normal American accent and they'll be like, you know, I just don't understand what you're doing. You know, like
every once in a while, an accent or a vowel comes out, and you're like, ooh.
It's when they sound like they're doing an accent, but you're like, I don't know what part of America you're supposed. Because right. I think that one in the second act was supposed to be Southern.
The
soldier.
Oh dear.
Or because there were times I was like, is he Southern? Because, and you're just like, oh, the pieces of this accent are not fitting together in a way that make any sense to my ear.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah. The last little complaint I have about the show. There were not many people there. It was a matinee. There was maybe, what, 30 people in the audience?
Yeah.
And a theater that probably held, what, 150, 200?
Probably at least 100.
I'd say more than that, probably. And it's not the type of show that's going to get, like, a standing ovation or a screaming applause. It's just not that type of show.
No, it's a very contemplative ending.
So, the curtain call had a group bow, and then individual bows for the entire cast, and then another group bow, but every bow had to happen twice because right. They had to bow to both sides. So this was a very, very long curtain call for an audience that was just waking up because they'd been asleep for the last half of Act Two.
Yeah.
And I felt like it put a really bad button on a okay experience of having to feel like I have to applaud for 2.5 minutes.
But the
for
a show that I don't really care. It's gotten pretty good reviews.
Yeah.
So maybe they're having better crowds at night. So maybe they do, you know, I don't think they want to have like two alternate versions of the
curtain. Sure, but, sure, sure.
However, I will say, even at the length that it was, the actors could be a little more enthusiastic.
Yeah.
So like,
although it's
don't good. Lean into the fact that we're just kind of like, eh, because they were kind of like, eh.
Yeah.
They were not super, like...
Thank you!
Well, like, a couple great? Of them, they'd do their bow, and then they'd really, like, enthusiastically point at the next actor coming in.
Uh-huh.
And then a couple of them did not do that.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, do you not like this person or whatever? And they were very... I think your acting job has to continue through the curtain call.
Yeah.
You have to act like it went great.
Of course.
Because I kind of started to think about, like, oh, are they... annoyed to have to even do the show today or whatever.
Right. And, there's nothing worse than an apologetic curtain call. Yeah. Like, I'm so sorry.
And then, so we're pretty much caught up to today.
Yeah.
We have tickets to see Six next Thursday. I just bought a ticket to see Bridges of Madison County at the Chocolate Factory
directed Tuesday. By John Doyle, right?
Trevor Nunn. I would not buy tickets to see a John Doyle.
You don't want
to
see whatever her name is, Francesca on tuba?
Nope. No, but I've never seen something... Like, I guess theoretically, since I've seen Les Mis, I've seen something directed by Trevor Nunn. Did you do that?
The original production, yeah.
Well, I mean, it's like his original direction, I'm sure, has like, I'm sure he came up with the flag waving and all that. Like,
yeah.
You know, so like, I'm seeing elements of his direction since then. Did he direct Cats?
Mm-hmm.
No. But anyway, no. He's, you know, he's obviously a major director from that time.
Yeah.
Of the spectacle British shows coming over.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to see him direct Bridges, which is not in that world.
Not a big show, no.
Yeah, so, and the last one the Broadway one was who's the guy who always has moving, he did King and I.
Bartlett Sher?
Yeah, it was Bartlett Sher. So, I feel like he always likes like skeletal set pieces moving around, because the barn in Bridges was just like
the frame
arches.
Yeah.
So a very minimal thing.
Was the because I only saw the National Tour of Bridges with you. Was that the same direction?
Yep.
Was it the same set and everything?
Yeah, same set and everything.
There,
I think there were a couple like little modifications, but it was basically the same
thing. Yeah, I mean, you're going to have to modify things to tour with, sure. So we have tickets for Six. I'm planning on hoping that we can see Big. There's a Tina Turner musical is running here. There's a production of 9 to 5 running here, which
no one is recommending that we see.
Right. Well, Brooke said it was fun.
Okay.
Brooke's, yeah.
Oh, she did.
She said it was fine.
What was the other one she saw?
I don't know.
As You Like It?
Maybe.
I think she went to the Globe yesterday.
Oh, yeah. You're right. Yeah. There's a new, play with John Malkovich running, which has
Bitter
got
Wheat, the new David Mamet play,
which has gotten
like horrific reviews,
scathing reviews.
Yeah. I will say we saw Queen of the Mist for £13.
Yeah, that's a great.
The other thing I was going to say about London being the best theater city is that face value, 10th row Hamilton tickets here are £200.
Yeah.
Which is...
like $300.
Yeah. But like you can get Hamilton mezzanine tickets for like £40 here.
Yeah.
There's no show that's like unreachably expensive here.
Right.
The only one is Fleabag.
Right, which is completely sold out anyway. Yeah,
Fleabag completely sold out.
But we can see Wicked for like £25.
Yeah. So it just feels a lot more...
which Chris has never seen, so we might go see.
Yeah, it feels a lot more in reach of regular people to see theater here and to create theater.
Yeah.
So.
I might want to check out Matilda again. I really loved that on Broadway and I haven't seen it. I only saw it the one time, so I might want to check that out again too. So there's a lot of options coming up.
A lot of theater. And we're at the King's Head until September 21st.
Mm-hmm. Then we play Exeter and...
Basingstoke.
After that.
And then we're going back to the U.S. And that's pretty much it.
Yeah.
We'll update you next week with other shows that we've seen.
Yes, we will.
Goodbye.
Bye.